The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. Hello, this is your hometown girl, Shadate Hargett Hill, from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm filling in for your regular reader, Derek Frost. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The topics that we'll be discussing: culture profit training, lynchpin of the 50 fastest growing private companies in the area. The list, highest paid nonprofit CEOs, a better world, assimilating refugees to provide for a better life. Technology, Lenovo adjusts local ops to parlay shift as the personal computer market consolidates. Lenovo initiates new methods to lower costs and recruit younger workers. In retail, could IKEA really be on Carytown's radar? Developers of the struggling mall in Cary say they are working with an in-demand retailer to anchor the shopping center. And in healthcare, Quinellis IMS chief talks merger boom. Tuari Boothbig, the new chief of the merged Quinellis IMS entity, hundreds of millions of dollars in savings are in the offing, but will Durham's legacy Quinellis end up shouldering most of the cuts in back office functions and IT operations? We'll have that and much more. In biz, a quick glance. Burt's Small House headed to Durham. The iconic turkey coop that was the home of the Burt's Bees founder is going to have a new resting place in Durham. Burt Chavez, the iconic bearded man behind the brand, died in 2015 at the age of 80. He had made a living selling honey until a chance encounter with hitchhiker Roxanne Quimby in 1984 sparked the launch of Burt's Bees. Chavez preferred the simple life of Maine and lived in the 300-square-foot converted turkey coop until building a house nearby. After that home burned, he returned to the coop for the final months of his life. Chavez sold his share of the company to Quimby for around $100,000 in 1999. The company sold to Clorox in 2017 for $900 million, and reports say Quimby gave him an additional $4 million then. The coop, which has no running water, has been moved to Burt's Bees headquarters on the American Tobacco campus in Durham and will be open to the public in December as a way to celebrate the company's past. Raleigh revives the hullabaloo. The owner of the hullabaloo says that she had plenty of options before deciding to bring the football game to Raleigh. Jennifer Logan, owner of Hullabaloo LLC, says the game, last held in 2008, will be in Raleigh in 2018. Logan says the bowl had to weigh both venues and competing all-star games when making its decision. Florida was a no-go, she explained, pointing to the East-West Shrine game. Los Angeles, Alabama, and South Carolina were ruled out for similar reasons. Chicago, too cold. New York, too expensive and too cold, she says. But Raleigh, with its indoor training facilities, became an early front runner. Plus, it works with the theme. The theme for the event will be between the pines, the pineapples and the pine trees, she says. And Raleigh has plenty of pine trees. The event will rotate between Raleigh and Hawaii and already has sponsorships, Logan says. NC Middle School lauded for amazing use of energy. A Hope County middle school designed by a Raleigh firm has been called the nation's most energy positive school. Sandy Grove Middle School in Lumberbridge has received the Energy Star 100 certification, according to Robbie Ferris, president of SFLNA Architects. Sandy Grove was designed with LEED platinum standards in mind, and the Holt County school system expects to save millions of dollars in the future. Ferris calls the school a perfect example of a high-performance facility. We utilized a public-private leaseback model where everyone wins. The students receive a quality school, it fits into the school system budget, and it is energy efficient to help both total cost and our environment. Cancer detection in dogs can benefit humans. Raleigh-based Centennial Biomedical has a unique approach to cancer research, focused on man's best friend, and you'll reap rewards for humans too. Started in 2015 by Dr. Matthew Breen, a professor at NC State University's College of Veterinary Medicine, Centennial Biomedical has developed a way to detect bladder cancer in dogs. The product is aimed at helping as many as 80,000 dogs each year, but also examining environmental impacts linked to cancer in dogs and humans. Breen says Centennial Biomedical is involved in a nationwide research project that asks dog owners submitting urine samples for testing to also answer environmental exposure questions on topics like water, flea and tick medicine, tobacco, and pesticides. That data can be compared to human incidences of cancer. It is actually allowing for progress in both fields simultaneously, he says. Centennial Biomedical's assay is currently being marketed through the company's website and the American Kennel Club. Shopping with a sense of purpose. More than 12,000 shoppers packed the Raleigh Convention Center for 4 days recently at the Junior League of Raleigh's annual A Shopping Spree event. Organizers tell Biz that proceeds from the event help support J.L. Julia Jones Daniel Center for Community Leadership and efforts that in recent years primarily focused on at-risk youths. Additionally, J.L. officials note the shopping event also helps the group's legacy fund. That fund has awarded some $175,000 to nonprofits since its launch in 2004. This year's Legacy Fund recipients were Haven House, Transitions Life Care, and Carol's Kitchen. We are proud to contribute a portion of funds raised at a shopping spree to these deserving charities. They work towards our mission at the Junior League of Raleigh to lift up children and women here in our community, says Rebecca Ayers, current president of the Junior League. Well done, ladies. Breaking news, reporter now leading pork council. You don't think of newspaper reporters as future leaders of the pork industry, or do you? A former reporter at the News and Observer has been named CEO of the North Carolina Pork Council, which promotes the pork industry across the state. Andy Curlis, a former investigative reporter and editor at the paper, was named Chief Executive Officer October 31st. He brings a unique perspective and a valuable skill set that will benefit our organization, says Stephen Williamson, chair of the council's board of directors. Turning now to On Real Estate. Aeropostale to close 5 stores in NC, one in the Triangle. Aeropostale, the teen apparel retailer that filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in the spring, apparently wasn't in such bad shape after all. The retailer's new ownership group has lowered its projection for expected store closings and will instead keep 504 of its 720 North American stores open, which is 26% more stores than it had projected would stay open after acquiring the brand for $243 million in mid-September. The retailer has still targeted those stores in North Carolina, 5 to be exact, slated to close by the end of the year, including the Aeropostale factory at Cary Town Center Mall in Cary and its stores in Burlington, Rocky Mount, Jacksonville, and Nags Head. Measurement Inc. to move scoring center staff from downtown Durham to Northgate Mall. Measurement Inc., a Durham-based educational testing company, is relocating the majority of its seasonal employees from its scoring center in downtown Durham to Northgate Mall in North Durham. The move is expected to bring about 300 to 400 part-time scoring experts to the North Durham shopping mall for about 5 to 6 months out of the year, plus a few full-time year-round employees, says Drew Medlin, a director at Measurement Durham LLC, who helped negotiate the lease deal. Measurement Inc. has signed a 7-year commitment for the space. And there's going to be a Target near NC State. Target on November 3rd confirmed the long-rumored store plans that the company will build and open a new store on Hillsborough Street in Raleigh, replacing the soon-to-close bowling center, The Alley. The 23,000-square-foot flexible-format store is expected to open in October 2017. The Alley Bowling Center will close November 26. Cary Town Center to make changes. IKEA confirms interest in Triangle. The top executives for Carytown Center Mall are lining up the cards for what is expected to be a game-changing redevelopment for one of Cary's most prominent retail centers. On a recent conference call with analysts and shareholders, Farzana Mitchell, Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer of Mall Owner CBL & Associates Properties, Inc., stated clearly that CBL is actively pursuing and purchasing options for redevelopment of the Carytown Center Mall property. This property is well located in the market, and we'll announce more details as we make progress on the redevelopment plans, Mitchell said, according to a transcript published by Seeking Alpha. Mitchell also stated that negotiations are underway with a very recognizable and in-demand retailer. Mitchell did not disclose the identity of the retailer, and a follow-up call with CBL spokeswoman Stacy Keating yielded no new information about the plan. What about IKEA, the global Swedish retailer known for its giant stores with a various assortment of modernist style home goods and furniture, as well as its famous Swedish meatballs? Joseph Roth, a spokesman for IKEA's public affairs group, says for now there's nothing to report about additional IKEA store expansion plans in the Carolinas, but Roth didn't rule it out either. We continue to evaluate opportunities in Raleigh-Durham area as they arise, he says. Certainly, we've recognized over the years and acknowledged it is a market that long-term can support a store. We have not found a site yet and will continue to evaluate opportunities. Durham kicks off $43 million renovation of courthouse on Main Street. The walls have started coming down at the old Durham County Judicial Building at the corner of Main and Mangum Streets in downtown Durham as the county begins work on a $43 million renovation and rehab that will last through mid-2018. The scope of the project includes a total reconfiguration of the building's interior spaces, replacement of all the major building systems, adding a fire protection system, and completely rearranging the elevator core. Once completed, the rehab building that was built in 1978 will house various Durham County administrative offices that will be relocated from other county-owned and leased spaces around the city, plus multiple meeting rooms and retail on the first floor where county leaders plan to sign a restaurant. The section on tech transportation says Lenovo jazzes up call center. The PC giant wants to appeal to millennials with a fresh approach. PC giant Lenovo debuted what it's calling its reinvention of the call center, a not-so-secret weapon in the recruitment of millennials this month in Morrisville. Scott Ottman, executive director of Inside Sales, assured the crowd gathered November 3rd that he didn't pick the colors and that the lined, writable walls, curvy couches, and swivel recliners. "You're not trying to attract somebody like myself," he said. The 400-member group working in the building includes the entire U.S. Inside Sales team. "This is sort of the first of several transformation projects that we are going to continue to design and execute here in Lenovo, and specifically the Triangle," Emilio Gilardi, president of Lenovo North America, told the crowd. In an interview following the ribbon cutting for the facility, Gilardi, who is taking an office in the new space, said that change won't just be reflected within the physical walls. "The PC business is in a state of consolidation," he said. "We had been talking about this for a while, and it's going to accelerate. You need to have enough money to invest, but you need to keep driving your cost structure down. Invention at the wrong cost structure is irrelevant." So that is what Gilardi and his team are changing. The cost structure. And it starts with sales. The cost structure of sales with Gilardi, referred to as a hybrid call center. A mix and match approach to selling. Lenovo is approaching the strategy segment by segment, starting in the public sector, where education has been the growth engine for its PC business in the U.S. for the last 2 years. The volume is big, but the average selling price of these units is actually very low, he said. So instead of dedicating an accounting executive to hit the school system in person every day, Lenovo is turning to the data it has been collecting on its own sale activities. That way, it can deploy an in-person executive when it's most effective, relying on the Morrisville's call center for the rest. The more data you have, the more you can predict the behavior of specific customer segments, he said. Ghilardi said Lenovo is designing the sales process of the future and that it's happening for Morrisville. When asked if Lenovo would be making cuts in the transition, he said every time people talk about transformation, there is a feeling that they might be hiding something nasty. If you transform yourself while you're growing, you have many good options. If you need to transform yourself because you're sinking, it's a completely different situation and you don't have many ways out. CEO tracks deals for entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs have already raised more than $600 million in North Carolina in 2016. That's according to a new report released by the Council for Entrepreneur Development, a Durham-based startup support organization. The report, which tracks equity fundraising in the state, shows 59 North Carolina startups in the technology, life sciences, advanced manufacturing and materials, and clean tech sectors collectively raised more than $175 million through 62 equity deals in the third quarter. The breakdown for the third quarter 2016, life sciences, 21 companies, 21 deals, $84.7 million. Technology, 27 companies, 30 deals, $46.3 million. Advanced materials and manufacturing, 9 companies, 9 deals, $36.6 million. Clean tech, 2 companies, 2 deals, $8.1 million. And she said, he said, she said, we've got a pretty solid base of early stage capital. Joan Servert Rose, CEO of CED, talking about the third quarter innovators report. He said, we're always focused on raising money around what our deployment capabilities are. We are big on investing ahead of growth. Michael Painter, managing partner of Plexus Capital, speaking shortly after the firm closed on a $400 million fund. Plexus invests in companies with between $10 million and $100 million in revenue. NCDOT partnership with Raleigh firm looking to solve last mile problem for train travelers. A new pilot partnership between North Carolina and Raleigh Transportation Technology, Upstart, Translock, could take you from your door to your destination via Uber, transit, and train, all with the touch of a few buttons. The NC Department of Transportation already partners with Amtrak to operate both the Piedmont and Carolinian trains. Via the 3-month pilot, Translock Rider app will provide passengers with seamless trip planning to and from several Amtrak stations, included in Raleigh, Cary, and Durham. Paul Worley, NCDOT Rail Division Director, says it's one way his team is leveraging technology to prep for the ridership boost expected after the completion of what's called the Piedmont Improvement Project, a massive Raleigh to Charlotte rail revamp. We want to be ready for the business traveler, for more people coming, he says. The partnership provides a solution to what he calls the last mile problem, where travelers have to get from the train station to their final destination. We think it's got some opportunity to connect our riders with services beyond our trains and to do it in a way that's efficient, Worley says. On now to pharma law. Quintiles IMS saving millions from more than expected by merger. In its first earnings call as combined company, Quintiles IMS announced November 2nd that it expects its cost synergies after the merger will double from its initial guidance and that it has authorized a $1.5 billion share repurchase. Analyzed cost savings are expected to be $200 million rather than $100 million exiting 2019, according to Quintiles IMS, and its share repurchase is expected to be completed by 2017. On the company's third quarter earnings call, CEO Ari Bousbib said cost synergies would not be derived from client-facing resources, rather areas like duplicated infrastructures and cost of doing business. Fourth quarter guidance was offered for the newly combined company, while third quarter earnings were reported separately. Fourth quarter revenue is expected to be between $1.95 billion and $1.99 billion, the company reported. National law firm making new push into Triangle. North Carolina and the Triangle have their fair share of law firms, but a 90-lawyer national plaintiffs firm has been noticeably absent from the legal landscape. That changed earlier this year, however, when Cohen, Milstein, Sellers, and Toll planted roots in Raleigh. Cohen, Milstein, known for bringing class action litigations against big-name defendants like Apple, Dow Chemical, and McDonald's, added NC's capital city to its list of existing offices in cities such as Washington, Chicago, and New York. North Carolina is one of the key places in the country where things are happening. It is a great opportunity because there are no plaintiff firms like us there, says Stephen Toll, managing partner of Cohen Milstein. In May, the firm hired former North Carolina Court of Appeals Judge Martha Geer to open Cohen Milstein's Raleigh outpost. In September, it recruited NC Senator Jay Chaudhuri. The firm has offices space at the Wells Fargo Capital Center downtown. We've been focusing on educating lawyers and law firms across the state about what Cohen Milstein can do in partnering with them, says Geer. Most plaintiff firms in the state are small shops with anywhere from one to five attorneys, she says. Many of them have indicated to me that they don't even think about the potential for class action or large civil litigation, says Geer. Salix might unload, report says. After acquiring Raleigh-based Salix Pharmaceuticals for $10 billion a year and a half ago, Valeant Pharmaceuticals International is considering selling it off. The Wall Street Journal reported November 1st, citing sources WSJ reported Takeda Pharmaceutical Company of Japan is in advanced talks to buy Salix for $8.5 billion in cash and future low royalty payments. A Salix sale would enable Valeant to pay off debts following an accounting scandal last year. In August, Valeant announced it had agreed to sell its North American commercialization rights to Salix hereditary and angina edema drug Recumbent for up to $125 million to Netherlands-based farming group NV. Earlier this summer, Valeant shelled out $47 million to settle a U.S. Department of Justice investigation launched in 2013 into promotional practices for one-time Salix products. Valeant also reported earlier this year that sales from Salix drug Xifaxan were lower than expected. Salix, which specializes in gastrointestinal drugs, was Raleigh's largest homegrown pharmaceutical company. Its acquisition by Valeant in 2015 meant hundreds of layoffs and a loss of local executives. And speaking of Valeant, seeing red over the pink pill. Former Sprout shareholders say Valeant has botched the female libido drug Adye. Little more than a year since Valeant Pharmaceuticals International announced its acquisition of Raleigh-based Sprout Pharmaceuticals for $1 billion, former Sprout shareholders are using Valeant over female libido drug Adye. A complaint filed November 2nd in Delaware court alleges Valeant breached the terms of its merger agreement by failing to develop and commercialize Sprout's former star product. According to the complaint, Valeant agreed to pay former Sprout shareholders $1 billion up front plus 40% of the future global product margin for Adyee. While original sales projections for Adyee from Valeant and Sprout topped $1 billion, the complaint states that Valeant sales of Adyee for 2016 are projected to be no more than $10 million and could be even less. Valeant's breach has not only damaged the former Sprout shareholders, but also deprived Valeant shareholders and debt holders of a significant source of revenue and deprived millions of women of a first-in-class drug option to treat a prevalent and unmet medical need, says Jonathan Skiller, manager partner at Boies, Skiller & Flexner. In a statement, Skiller is representing Plaintiff Shareholder Representative Services, LLC, as representative of the former Sprout shareholders in the lawsuit. The complaint states that not only did Valeant hike Adyee's price to $800 versus the planned $400 price point, but that the company also sought to sell Adyee through Philidor, its one-time specialty pharmacy, which was under criminal investigation. It further alleges that Valeant failed to make necessary sales and marketing expenditures for Adyee and employing a 150-person sales staff and remove an alcohol co-use restriction. It's not the first time former Sprout shareholders have been dissatisfied with Valeant's marketing of Adyee. Earlier this year, former Sprout shareholders penned a letter to Valeant's leadership expressing similar concerns. While former CEO Cindy Whitehead is involved in the matter, according to the source familiar with the situation, the lawsuit is being brought on behalf of all former Sprout shareholders. Whitehead did not respond to a request for a comment. Valeant also declined to comment. Chapel Hill Company gets FDA committee support for pneumonia drug. A U.S. Food and Drug Administration Advisory Committee hearing November 4th concluded positively for Chapel Hill-based Sempra's pneumonia drug. The company voted 7-6 in favor of the drug, which the company says is not susceptible to antibiotic resistance, finding that it is an effective treatment for community-acquired pneumonia and that its benefits outweigh the risk of hepatotoxicity or liver damage. It asks for additional data for risk assessment. President and CEO Prahavathi Fernandez says Sempra appreciated the supportive view and thoughtful comments from the panel. While the FDA is not required to follow the conclusions of its advisory committee, it usually does. In news, Delwig buys Triangle Office Park for $41.5 million. Durham real estate investment and management firm, the Degwill Companies, have added four more Class A office buildings to its portfolio of properties in the Triangle. But the deal was also a personal victory for the company and its CEO, Anthony Delwig. Delwig, on November 7th, finalized its $41.5 million purchase of the Quadrangle 2, 3, 4, and 5 buildings that total 264,410 square feet of office space located near the intersection of Interstate 40 and NC 54. It was also the Chapel Hill Office Park where Delwig, a former quarterback at Duke University and in the NFL, switched to commercial real estate in 1994, joining Vanguard Associates as a broker representing tenants and landlords in lease negotiations. He left the firm to start his own commercial real estate investment group in 1999. The Quadrangle properties have a Chapel Hill address but are located in Durham County. Anchor tenants within the park include the headquarters of local health science firms Roe, Sempra Pharmaceuticals, and IntraHealth International, plus the local office of transportation software firm TMW Systems. At the time of sale, the buildings were 91% leased, according to new releases from Delwig. The seller was Property Reserve, Inc. of Salt Lake City. The transaction did not include Quadrangle 1, the oldest property on the oldest property on the campus, built in 1986, which is owned by California-based Exandria Real Estate. The four quadrangle office properties sold to Delwig were built between 1988 and 1996. Delwig notes that the firm plans to invest more than $2.5 million in improvements to buildings, operating systems, common areas, and amenities. The Class A office market is incredibly strong in Chapel Hill, according to Delwig. Delwig stated, Quadrangle is well located to capture the market's future growth, and we look forward to enhancing these buildings. The acquisition boosts Delwig's holdings to nearly 1.4 million square feet of office space in the region and 5.7 million square feet across the southeast. The HFF Carolinas investment sales team represents the seller and was led by Ryan Clutter, Scott Humphrey, and Chris Lingerfelt. NetTap announces a company-wide layoff. Following news of another company-wide layoff round, NetApp has confirmed it won't be meeting its next set of milestones for a planned expansion in Research Triangle Park. We don't foresee an opportunity to meet the growth projection terms of this contract for the current calendar year, NetApp spokeswoman Amelia Viara said in an email. We will work with the state to determine the appropriate next steps. NetApp is streamlining and doesn't plan to meet job targets promised for 4 years ago in RTP. Viera points out that the company fulfilled two job creation contracts with the state in 2004 and 2007, and it met its contract obligations for 2013 and 2014 for the latest growth pledge. But given the state of the industry, she says, the company first defaulted on its target for 2015. NetApp pledged in 2012 to create 460 jobs over 4 years, investing nearly $75 million at the site. In exchange, the California company was approved for nearly $12 million in state incentives. Now it's time to take a look at the list. Highest paid nonprofit CEOs ranked by the latest reportable compensation from the organization. At number 25, Jonathan Erickson, United Methodist Retirement Homes, located at 2600 Crossdale Farm Parkway in Durham. The reportable compensation from the organization, $172,477. The organization description, to provide quality care and services for inclusive and diverse population of senior adults. And the organization's 2005 tax year revenue, $59,714,197. At number 24, Kevin McDonald, Trosa Inc., located 820 James Street in Durham. Their reportable compensation was $173,800. Their organization's 2015 tax year revenue, $15,496,210. They are a multi-year residential program that enables substance abusers to be productive, recovering individuals by providing comprehensive treatment, work-based vocational training, education, and continuing care. At number 23, Philip Harewood, Lincoln Community Health Center at Durham, P.O. Box 52119. Their reportable compensation for the organization, $175,336. Their organization's 2015 tax year revenue, $28,281,432. They provide comprehensive health care in courteous, professional, and personalized manner. Number 22, Jennifer Tolley Whiteside, North Carolina Community Foundation, located at 4601 Six Forks Road, number 524 in Raleigh. The reportable compensation was $178,141. The organization's 2015 tax year revenue, 70,743,467. They serve charitable donors, nonprofit organizations, and communities statewide. At number 21, Robert Coger, North Carolina Advanced Energy Corporation, located here in Raleigh. The reportable compensation is a little more than $187,000. The organization's 2015 tax year revenue is a little bit less than $8 million. They work to moderate the rise in demand for electricity and to help shift demands to off-peak periods. At number 20, Thomas Reiser, International Society of Thrombosis and Hematosis, Inc., located at Carrboro, North Carolina. Their reportable compensation was actually a little less than $189,000. Their revenue for 2015 was approximately about $3 million. They are there to advance the understanding, prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of thrombotic and bleeding disorders. At number 19, Lisa Jones, Girl Scouts North Carolina Coastal Pines, located here in Raleigh. Their reportable compensation is at $189,000, and their return revenue for 2015 was approximately $9 million. They are dedicated solely to girls, where in accepting and nurturing environment, girls build courage, confidence, character, and skills for success in the real world. And I'm going to read the other ones. And basically at number 18, we have Wendy McAllister of Raleigh, and their tax revenue would be at a little less than $25 million. They're here to help students prepare successfully for college and to find the best financial aid alternatives. At number 17, John Ackerman, Boy Scouts of America, located in Raleigh. Their revenue is at a little more than $4 million, and they're teaching youth boys important youth skills. Excuse me. At number 16, Reynolds Kohlfelder, Southlight Inc., located in Raleigh. Their revenue was a little over $7 million, and they develop and implement comprehensive substance abuse treatment programs for youth, adults, and families. Number 15, Brian Toomey, Piedmont Health Services Inc., located in Carrboro, North Carolina. Their 2015 tax revenue was at a little less than $40 million. And they are ambulatory health care service. And number 14, Alan Wayne, Durham Exchange Club Industries, located in Durham. Their organization's 2015 tax year revenue is at a little less than $5 million. They are a vocational rehabilitation program serving adults with disabilities. And number 13, David Dodson, MDC Inc., located in Durham, North Carolina. The tax revenue for 2015 was a little less than $5 million. They are there to help organizations and communities close the gap that separates people from opportunity. And number 12, Mac Kuntz, United Way of the Greater Triangle, located in Morrisville, North Carolina. They have an organization 2015 tax year revenue is set at a little less than $17 million. They are there to raise money for various nonprofit services in the community and to provide various direct services to the community. At number 11, Dennis McLean, Goodwill Community Foundation, located at Durham. Their tax year revenue for 2015 is at a little more than $35 million. They provide an environment for people to improve the quality of their lives through employment and learning opportunities with a focus on persons with disabilities. At number 10, Doug McMillan, YMCA of the Triangle, located in Raleigh, North Carolina. Their tax revenue for 2015 is at a little over $85 million. They are there to help people develop values and behavior that are consistent with Christian principles. And number 9, Lauren Durant, located in Durham, North Carolina. the North Carolina. The offices is B&D Behavioral Health Services, and their 2015 tax year revenue was at a little over $7 million, and it is a behavioral health clinic. And number eight, Elizabeth McGuire at IPAS USA, located in Durham. Their tax revenue for 2015 was at a little over $33 million. They're there to educate women on the rights to reduce deaths and injuries of women from unsafe abortions. And number seven, Stephen Wegner, Access Care, located in Morrisville, North Carolina. Their revenue for 2015 was about $25 million. They're there to provide medical care to Medicaid, Medicare, and uninsured populations of North Carolina. And number six, Susan Braun, the V Foundation, located in Cary, North Carolina. Their tax year revenue for 2015 continues to be steady at a little over $28 million, and this is a foundation for cancer research. At number five, Pappy Gay, IntraHealth International, Inc. in Chapel Hill. 2015 tax year revenue is at a little over $82 million, and they are there to improve the quality and accessibility of health services for people in need around the world. At number four, Walter Kleismeyer, Planned Parenthood South Atlantic, located in Raleigh. Their 2015 tax year revenue is at a little over $17 million. They're there to help couples make informed reproductive decisions. Number three, Dana Bull, Community Affordable Housing Equity Corps. They are located in Raleigh, and their 2015 tax year revenue is set at a little over $9 million. They are there to help finance the development of affordable rental housing in North Carolina. At number two, William Zeifel, Divers Alert Network Foundation, located in Durham. Their revenue for 2015 is about $7 million. They help divers in need with emergency medical information assistance and referrals, and promotes dive safety through research, education, products, and services. And at number one, William Hudson, LC Industries, located in Durham, North Carolina. The 2015 tax year revenue is a little over $68 million. They provide quality employment to Durham residents with blindness. And that's the list, the highest paid nonprofit CEOs. In Money Matters, how exactly is nonprofit CEO paid determined? According to the Council of Nonprofits, the Board of Directors is responsible for hiring and establishing the compensation, salary, and benefits of the Executive Director, CEO, by identifying compensation that is reasonable and not excessive, but that is also attractive enough to retain the best possible talent to lead the organization. IRS definitions, the compensation agreement must be approved in advance by an authorized body of the applicable tax-exempt organization, which is composed of individuals who do not have a conflict of interest concerning the transaction. Prior to making its determination, the authorized body obtained and relied upon appropriate data as to comparability, and the authorized body adequately and timely documented the basis for its determination concurrently with making that determination. In the list by the numbers, $6.91 million, the cumulative report of compensation received by the nonprofit CEOs on the list in the latest 990 tax filings. $700 million, the cumulative revenue of the most recent tax year of the organizations represented on this year's list. 13, the number of CEOs on the list who had reportable compensation of more than $200,000 in their organization's latest 990 tax filing. And 10, the number of nonprofits on the list that operate out of Durham, the highest contingent on the list. Raleigh was a close second at 9. Moving on to small business. Internal strife can challenge family businesses. This is by James Lee. Some people will tell you that a leader is characterized by an unwavering eyes front posture, chin up, face to the sun, focus on the horizon. But the leader of a family business also has to focus on what's going on around and even behind him or her. The horizon is where the next marketplace challenge or opportunity will arise. The next surprising little family business twist, however, will likely pop up inside the chief's own tent. This column's highly relative surveillance task force, a crack team of MBA students with their eyes on the ball and their ears to the keyhole, has assembled the following list of good signs and bad signs to help you keep up with what's going on inside your family business. It's a good sign for the family business when Dad strolls out of his office and announces, "I don't remember giving you guys raises last year, so I'll be putting another 10% in your pay envelope starting the end of this month." That usually means that Mom has been on his case about starving his children for the sake of his company. He's hoping that the 10% will keep the peace. It's a good sign when Uncle Claude volunteers to sell his stock back to the company to avoid diluting ownership by willing the stock to his heirs. Claude's kids take a somewhat dim view of the decision until they figure out how much cash will be coming their way. It's a good sign when a key non-family executive, having been told the next CEO will be a family member, signs a long-term employment contract anyway. She says she believes in the company, the family, and the way they're doing business. But it's a bad sign when the son, who's the designated successor, keeps getting the company's name wrong. He can never seem to remember whether it's J.R. Smith & Company or the J.R. Smith Company. Hey, he says, what's the difference? It's a good sign when the family council votes to set up a charitable foundation to return some of the fruits of success to the community where it has done business for 50 years. It's a good sign when the founders recognize the company has outgrown its folksy style of management and agree to establish a board of directors, including some well-qualified outsiders, to help run the business. It's a good sign when all three kids acknowledge that none of them has the skill or commitment to run the company. They urge their parents to keep ownership of the business in the family, but to search for non-family executives to head the company. But it's a bad sign when no two family members have the same ideas about the future of the company and the family's relationship to it. There's a clear need for action to turn a bunch of unmotivated dreamers into a coherent team with a shared vision for the family business. It's a good sign for the family business when all family members working in the company and their spouses agree to a new compensation plan that ties pay and perks directly to individual and corporate performance. It's a good sign for the family business when a potential conflict over who will lead the company after Dad retires evaporates like morning dew on the barrel cactus. The two younger family members who were gearing for battle suddenly realize how easily a shootout could blow big holes in the company itself. They opt for a non-lethal means of selecting the next CEO. But it's a bad sign for the family business when the founder's retirement party falls flat because the guest of honor has decided not to retire for the fourth time. Good signs, bad signs. They show up in almost all family businesses. The important thing is to recognize them and know how to respond. James Lee is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. Contact him at james.lee, that's L-E-A, at yourfamilybusiness.net. Around the state, Duke Energy looks to pass hurricane costs to consumers. Duke Energy expects to spend $200 million to repair the damage done to its operations by Hurricane Matthew across the Carolinas and Florida. Duke CEO Lynn Good said that one storm has swamped Duke's 2016 storm repair fund of $40 million. The company will be asking regulators in the three states to allow the company to recover those costs from customers. It was an extraordinary effort on the part of our crews, Good says. I feel like we performed well and demonstrated great commitment to the communities, which is what we expect. The storm flooded 115 Duke substations in eastern North Carolina and South Carolina, damaging about 800 transformers on the site. The storm destroyed 58 transmission towers, the large steel leg test work structures that support the system's high voltage wires, and toppled nearly 2,000 utility poles. The floodwaters also caused a 50-foot breach in the cooling pond dam at Duke Energy Progress HF Lee plant near Goldsboro. Storm Director Bob Simpson said last week that power has been restored to every Duke customer that can be connected to the grid. The property for about 1,400 customers is so badly damaged that it is not safe to restore power to them. Those properties will either be repaired, in some cases entirely rebuilt, or abandoned. But he says the initial work involved just getting customers' power restored. Duke still has to go through and repair, rebuild, and replace a lot of its own infrastructures damaged by the storm. Good says because of that, the current estimate is preliminary and could change somewhat. We're still gathering details on what that details would be and the estimate, she says, but we are estimating around $200 million for now. By far, the greatest damage was done to Duke Energy Progress, which covers the Eastern Carolinas. Yum! Belgian cookie baker comes to NC. Belgium-based Lotus Bakeries maker of the popular Biscoff cookies served by airlines will open its first U.S. manufacturing operation in Alamance County, a $50 million facility that will employ 60 by December 31, 2020. The facility will be built by Greensboro-based Samant Core at the NC Industrial Center in Mebane. Lotus Bakeries plans to add bakers, packagers, quality assurance specialists, and other employees to its new Mebane facility. The average salary for the jobs is expected to be $35,931. Lotus facility will add a total annual payroll of $2.1 million. Jan Boone, CEO of Lotus Bakery, said the company's U.S. plant is a major step for the Belgium firm. For the first time since our foundation in 1932, Biscoff will be produced outside of Limbeek, Belgium, Boone said. The city of Mebane and Alamance County approved a total of $2.9 million worth of incentives, and North Carolina provided a performance-based grant of up to $180,000. LendingTree expanding in Charlotte. LendingTree will invest $47 million and double the employee base of its Charlotte headquarters over the next 5 years. Charlotte Chamber and State Commerce officials announced November 2nd. The online lender's corporate expansion will create 314 jobs during that time span. LendingTree currently employs a staff of more than 360 people, split mostly between Charlotte and its California office. Of the total employees, 287 are based in North Carolina. North Carolina is the intersection of finance and technology, and LendingTree's expanded headquarters campus just made their intersection even busier. NC Commerce Secretary John Skrvla said in a company-prepared statement, "This innovative company provides valuable financial tools for U.S. consumers, and the Charlotte region will continue to be an integral part of their success." As part of the announcement, Skrvla said LendingTree is eligible to receive up to $4.9 million in reimbursements from the state's Job Development Investment Grant. In the section A Better World, refugees get help, a helping hand in Carrboro. Orange County is home to an estimated 1,300 refugees, mainly from Burma and Thailand, and more recently from Syria and the Democratic Republic of Congo. About 15 new refugees arrive every month. Refugees often do not speak English, lack documentation of their previous education or work, and are not familiar with U.S. social systems, says Madison with U.S. Social Systems. This comes from Madison Hayes, Executive Director of the Refugee Community Partnership in Carrboro. They often experience chronic isolation, she says, resulting in reinforcing persistent poverty, mental health problems, and exclusion from opportunities, particularly access to higher education, jobs, health care, and insurance. The partnership, founded in 2011, serves refugee families, students, and women. It operates with an annual budget of $30,000. A half-time executive director, It operates with an annual budget of $30,000, a half-time executive director, interpreters who work under contract, and more than 70 volunteers. At the core of its work, teams of two volunteers each visit 42 families in their homes each week, working collaboratively with the families to find solutions to challenges they identify, such as learning English, finding better housing, or navigating the community. The partnership also matches about 30 undergraduate students at UNC Chapel Hill, one-on-one with a total of 42 students at Chapel Hill High and East Chapel Hill High. The UNC student serves as academic mentors. The students at each high school also meet weekly in a club facilitated by partnership volunteers. Through a collaboration with Durham nonprofit Farmer Food Share, the partnership gets fresh local produce donated by farmers and consumers at Carrboro Farmers Market, feeding more than 130 individual refugees a week. It supports two groups of about six women each who meet in their homes on a rotating basis to talk about issues. Each has domestic violence and mental health, and about how to find services and resources to address them, Hayes says. To help refugee families overcome fear they may have about public or crowded spaces, the partnerships host a community outing every 3 months, and it offers about three workshops a year on topics such as road laws, driving, mental health, college readiness, and tax preparation. It plans within the next year to double to 100 and 140, respectively, the number of families it serves and volunteers working with them. It also plans to make its executive director a full-time employee, add a full-time program coordinator, and triple its annual budget. And within 6 months, it aims to launch a new program to plug refugee entrepreneurs into a collaborative network it has developed among local service providers, businesses, experts, policymakers, and other groups that can help them start new businesses. Our work is not to duplicate what already exists, Hayes says, but to connect refugees with resources in ways that are currently sensitive and socially strengthening. Well, we've run out of time for this edition of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. If you would like to become a sponsor of Triangle Business Journal, please call 919-832-5138. I'm your hometown girl, Shadate Hargett Hill, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time. I see you on the radio.